Thank you. So thanks. I've had a lot of fun. It's always nice to come up and spend some time here. I, like Licia and a couple other people, point out as we start our talks that you know there's sort of a more formal bent to a lot of the conference. You know, a lot of holography. So I decided to just sort of quantify that. I don't know if you know this website Wordle, but you can take any document and it will represent the frequency with which words appear by their size. So I took all the titles of all the talks here at this conference and I wordled them so we could see sort of what are the key themes. And you can see that, you know, inflation, holographic, non-Gaussian, and sitter are all fairly important ideas. What I'm going to talk about is this one right here, matter. So dark is big, yeah, dark is big. But you know, but I'm only talking about a small part of the dark. I'm talking about the matter part of the dark. Note that non-Gaussianity and non-Gaussianities appear both here. So, you know, it goes both ways. Anyhow, so the point is of this is just to say that not everybody has necessarily been following what's been going on in the dark matter world of late. It's been a very exciting time. But what I'd like to do today is to sort of, certainly for the non-experts, give you some background on what's been making things exciting and give you an update on what the current thinking is about where these ideas are going. So why are we thinking about new directions in dark matter? Well, most of the motivation for dark matter, I'm going to be focusing on WIMP dark matter, has always come from the theory side. This is this classic paper that if anybody does dark matter, they reference at some point in their paper somewhere. And a lot of the previous work was always driven by theory, right? So you have the strong CP problem, you have the theory of axions that drives something, you have supersymmetry, then you have the LSP that drives another theory. So you had theoretical constructs that drove us to think about certain models of dark matter, but in the last few years that's really shifted, and now there's a lot more emphasis on anomaly-driven dark matter. So you have things that may or may not be related to dark matter and are making us change our thinking about what the generic properties of dark matter might be. So why you might want to think about anomaly-driven dark matter or comes to the statement that I was just in a conference in Seattle, and I was talking to Ann Nelson, who's a really great phenomenologist, and she made this comment while I was there. She said, in the instances where new physics was found in my lifetime, it was almost never predicted, and when it was, and it wasn't because we couldn't or hadn't written down the model, but because the range of parameter space was considered unnatural or unmotivated. And instances of this are things like the properties of neutrino masses, the top quark mass, the value of the cosmological constant, which, by and large, within the community, were all greeted with a lot of surprise when they turned out to be what they were. And so whether or not these anomalies actually end up being about dark matter, one thing that's really useful is they push us to look in new corners of parameter space, even if in new phenomenology, even if these models are things that we could have in principle, and in some cases did, in fact, write down ahead of time. So what are the anomalies that are pushing us to think about new dark matter? So just in case you fall asleep or the USA-Slovenia game gets really exciting and you get distracted, let me tell you the basic conclusions now. There are two really major anomalies or classes of anomalies that are pushing us to think about different models of dark matter. You've got DAMA, which is a direct detection experiment, and you've got evidence of high-energy cosmic ray positrons and electrons that are showing us potential signs of dark matter annihilation. And we're going to find that both of these anomalies are very difficult to understand with standard dark matter and push us in new directions. And those new directions are basically grouped into dark matter with more interesting properties than we've been thinking about. We've been thinking about dark matter which only interacted through weak interactions. Now we're thinking about dark matter with new forces, new long-range forces of the sort that Maxime was talking about, so femtometer range forces, and dark matter with excited states. And so the final question is, and there's actually been increasing controversy about this over the past, I would say, few months, and in particular a paper that I'll make a couple comments on in the last month, can these proposals really explain what's being seen? And the answer to that at the moment, I think, is still yes, But I think that as the experiments have gotten better, we're entering into a regime that may be in a bit more tension. But tension also can just mean that you're on the verge of discovery. So what are the anomalies that are motivating us? I'll talk about the ones in more detail that are very relevant, but just so you have them all in front of you all at once. The things that cause people to think about new models of dark matter, you have the Dama annual modulation signature, which I'll talk about more. You have the WMAP haze, which is excess microwaves in the galactic center region, which could be coming from dark matter annihilation. You have the Fermi haze, which is excess gamma rays coming from the galactic center, which could be coming from dark matter. Then you've got signs of nearby electronic production. You've got Pamela, which looks at positrons, and you've got Fermi, which looks at electrons. Both of them see things which are not consistent with expectations. Then you have some things that are sort of more peculiar in how they fit into a framework. You've got Cogent, which recently announced that they have an excess of events at low energies, which could, if it's dark matter, would have to be something very peculiar and fairly light. And Integral, which is an excess of huge excess of very spherical 511 keV, so low energy positron production. Cogent is measuring ionization signals. It's a germanium detector. So the idea is that they it was really set out as a trial experiment for Majorana and as an experiment to rule out the light dark matter range of Dama. So it was never really designed as an especially good dark matter detector. It's been designed as a much better dark matter rule outer. So they're very well designed to see nothing. And they look for ionization signals in the center of a germanium detector. And it's hard to see right here, but the signal is actually this. See this peak here? It's not that. It's next to it. This exponentially falling thing, they claim they have cannot understand within their known background. But the ones that I want to focus on, really, are the high-energy electrons and positrons and direct detection from Dama and Libra. And I'll actually take you through what those anomalies are and why there's tension, because I know not everybody is an expert. So what are the new directions that we're pursuing? Well, mostly the new directions that we're pursuing are related to the presence of new dark forces. And this is an idea apparently is the thing is that if we're in Canada, I should point out that this is Bob Holdham from Canada. Comes back to Bob Holdham, who considered the idea that dark matter could interact with a new force, and interesting phenomenology can come from that. You can have dark matter annihilating into some new force, and you can have dark matter scattering off of nucleons by exchanging that new force, so you have the ability when these new particles, these new force carriers decay into standard model states, you have the possibility of seeing getting cosmic ray signals from this, and you get dark matter scattering in a direct detection experiment from this. And what's amazing is that if you think about dark forces sort of in the GeV range, so 100 MeV to GeV range, that have some appreciable coupling to ordinary matter, you would think that would be very excluded. But actually, the experimental constraints on that are not very weak, or excuse me, are not very strong. So if you parameterize this in terms of alpha prime divided by alpha, where alpha is the electromagnetic coupling, so if you think of there being some sort of kinetic mixing curve between F mu nu, the dark F mu nu, and R F mu nu epsilon, this mixing is this is something like epsilon squared. So a natural value, if you're thinking of this as a loop factor, a natural value of this would be somewhere, you know, in this range. But at any rate, these black ranges are ruled out, and this whole white range in here is allowed. So there's actually a huge range of parameter space for sort of interesting ranges of masses that has not been explored, even with fairly strong couplings, relatively speaking. So the general framework that I'm thinking about is in the context of WIMPs. WIMPs have been a very popular idea for a long time, not just because they appear in particle physics theories, but because actually we have some chance of detecting them. So the usual story for a WIMP is that it's in thermal equilibrium in the early universe, right? So you've got energy going back and forth between the two sectors of the theory. And as the universe cools down, the abundance of dark matter continues to deplete until this process falls out of equilibrium. When this process falls out of equilibrium, if the cross-section is very weak, you fall out of equilibrium early, and there's a lot of dark matter around. If the cross-section is very strong, you fall out of equilibrium very late. and so the cross-section is very big. And so there's an approximate relationship between the strength of this diagram and the amount of dark matter in the universe. And this is the so-called Wimp miracle, where you can relate omega h squared to this annihilation cross-section, and you find that the characteristic scale of that cross-section should be roughly weak scale. This is the so-called Wimp miracle, that generic particles with masses and interactions, which are set by the weak scale, naturally give you roughly the right amount of dark matter within, say, five orders of magnitude. It's not a really amazing miracle. What's that?
Miracle.
So it's like a Unitarian miracle.
I want to start off with direct detection and direct detection anomalies. So how do you detect a WIMP? First you should build a big detector. So how big of a detector do you want to build? Well, if you want to know how big of a detector to build, you need to know how big of a cross-section you should be expecting. My mom's Unitarian. Say that. So. So how big of a cross-section do you want to think about? Well, there's roughly two cross-sections in the standard model you should keep in mind. Dark matter scattering off of a nucleon through a Z exchange and dark matter scattering off of a nucleon through Higgs exchange. The characteristic size of the Z exchange is about 10 to the minus 39 centimeters squared. This is actually not a cross-section. People in dark matter business don't talk about cross-sections. They talk about cross-sections per nucleon. So you calculate the scattering cross-section off of a single proton or neutron, and then you can scale that to different targets, because germanium and iodine and tungsten will all have different atomic numbers, and so different cross-sections, because it will scale like roughly the atomic number squared. 10 to the minus 39 centimeters squared per nucleon for a Z exchange, and about 10 to the minus 45 centimeters squared for a Higgs exchange. This is just because the Higgs coupling is about 10 to the minus 3 down from the Z coupling. What about in these types of models, if we're thinking about not just standard model type scattering, but what about these scatterings? I'm going to be especially thinking about dark matter, where dark matter comes in and scatters into an excited state for reasons that I'll make clear later. And we're thinking about dark matter, which it interacts with a force. That force then kinetically mixes through some small mixing parameter and then scatters off the nucleon. So the cross-section that you get, you can just write down the cross-section parametrically. It's just alpha dark, whatever this coupling is, times alpha electromagnetic, that coupling there, times this mixing parameter squared, divided by m pi to the fourth, and then reduced mass squared. And so in principle, you look at this and you think that you've got no handle on how big this should be at all, because this epsilon squared can go over many orders of magnitude, and this dark matter mass, this mediator mass, whatever this phi particle here is mediated, can also go over many orders of magnitude. But there's actually a very nice point that was made by these authors here, that there's actually a fairly robust scale invariance in these theories about the size of direct detection cross-sections that you want to get when you make these theories supersymmetric. So if I start with a kinetic mixing term in my theory, epsilon, F mu nu, EM, F mu nu, dark, then when you make that a supersymmetric theory, then you just promote it to this term of the superpotential, which when you pull out the D terms is just a cross term between the hypercharged D term and the dark D term, at least for the purposes I want to discuss here. So when the hypercharged D term gets an expectation value just because the Higgs bep turn on, this turns on an effective Fi term for sources the dark D term. So it naturally sets a dimensionful scale in the dark sector, which is basically epsilon times the Suzy scale squared. So the characteristic dark scale, the dark force scale, is just epsilon down from the Suzy scale. So if you put in those parametrics, the cross-section is epsilon squared over all this. That's epsilon squared over epsilon squared dy squared. The epsilons cancel, and you find that the rough cross-section is basically set dimensionally by the hypercharged D term, which is roughly the weak. And this is, again, a statement which varies over a few orders of magnitude. But there's something very nice, which is that the robust cross-section that you might expect in Suzy theories is roughly the same as you would have in the standard model as well. So there's a reason to be optimistic that these sorts of models could be detected. So if you take a cross-section now, when I scale it up to the size of a detector, to the nuclei in question, this is about 10 to the minus 36 centimeters squared cross-section. So for WIMPs with characteristic velocities of 300 kilometers per second, you find that with these kinds of interactions, if you have a few kilogram detector, then you can expect a few events in about a year of running. So standard size experiments running for ordinary human periods of time actually have the possibility of making some detection. Any update? Any update? Oh, 1-0? Wait, who scored? Oh, I missed it. Well, I can't go on now. So there's been a major effort to find these few events, and different experiments have different attempts to find them. You go deep underground, you get rid of all of your background from cosmic rays, and it turns out that this step three, have no additional background, is the really hard part. So let me talk about two attempts to get rid of all other background, one which is positive, one which is negative. So one idea to get rid of all other background is to use the annual modulation of dark matter. So if you have the Milky Way and we're rotating through the around the center of the galaxy, since the dark matter halo does not have cooling, it's expected to stay very large and poofy with relatively low angular momentum, or even if it has the same angular momentum as the disk, to stay very large and be slowly rotating. So that means it's more or less stationary as we rotate through it. So there should be an incident wind of dark matter upon us as we rotate through the galaxy. But as we continue to go around the sun, sometimes in the summer we're moving into the wind, while in the winter we're moving out of the wind. So you actually expect an annual modulation. You expect more signal in the summer than you do in the winter. And this is what the DOM experiment looked for. They don't actually have, there's no plot with all of their data on one. So this has both their old experiment and their new experiment. Their old experiment was a 100 kilogram sodium iodide target. Their new experiment is a 250 kilogram sodium iodide target. And what you're looking at here is the residual when you subtract off the mean in any given period of time. So this is the signal they have minus the mean. This is the signal they have in as a function of time. And so the black line, if it's not obvious, is supposed to draw your eye as to what a modulation should look like. And it's maybe not super convincing. It's more convincing as a Fourier analysis in the smaller target. But in the newer target, it's fairly convincing that you can see that there's a modulation. So I think everybody in the business is absolutely convinced that there is a modulation there, but it's not obvious that this is coming from dark matter. There are a couple of other requirements they make, that this is only in single hit events, so a neutron will scatter in multiple detectors, whereas dark matter will only scatter in one detector. You expect it to have the proper phase, which is roughly the beginning of June, is when it should peak, and backgrounds will extend over a wide range of energies, whereas dark matter only has enough kinetic energy to be in the lowest energy bin, so it meets those criteria, but that's not necessarily enough to make it clear that this is, in fact, dark matter. So, yeah.
The right phase? I mean, what roughly whatever.
Well, that's hard to say because we don't actually have the data. Within about 14 days is what they quote, depending on which bins you look at. But sort of within it's certainly within 2 sigma is consistent. If you look at some of the lower energy bins, I would say they're not 1 sigma consistent, but they are 2 sigma consistent with that phase. I probably won't talk about this much, but if you're talking about models that have sensitivity to very high velocity particles, then the velocity doesn't necessarily, this is all the phase is assuming you have a Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution of particles. If you're sensitive to only the highest velocities, then deviations from Maxwell-Boltzmann can change the phase because the majority of particles are typically not coming from the direct wave movement. So, but it's, you know, it's more or less consistent.
So other experiments have attempted to get around this. Rather than using something like annual modulation, they've attempted to use event discrimination. So DAMA just looks for flashes in a scintillator. They don't look to try to tell whether a particular flash happened to be dark matter or happened to be a photon coming from some decay in their photomultiplier tube. So other experiments attempt to actually really on an event-by-event basis say this was a dark matter event and this was not a dark matter event. And they use many different channels to do this. So this is just a slide I stole from a Xenon 100 experimentalist. so the different experiments use things like looking for phonons, measuring the total energy, ionization, or scintillation. Those are basically what you use. And then some experiments use a combination of those two things. So a prime example of this is xenon. The idea is that if you have your backgrounds are mostly photons and electrons that get into your experiment mostly from radioactivity of the experiment itself. And an electron coming through your experiment is going to deposit its energy by hitting another electron, right? Because just they have the same mass. Whereas a WIMP, if it's got 100 GeV mass, will deposit its energy by hitting a nucleus, because the whole bowling ball, ping pong ball, momentum transfer thing that we all have done many times. So what you really want to do is tell whether your signal is an event is a nuclear recoil or a an electronic recoil. And so xenon experiment does this by comparing two properties of the signal. So if a particle comes in and it hits something, there's an initial flash of light that you detect. There's also an ionization signal as that particle slows down. And then that ionization, those electrons drift up to the detector and you detect them. Electrons will ionize more. Nuclei will ionize less. So you can compare the ratio of ionization energy to scintillation energy. And this is what they do. So all this is background. This stuff down here is supposed to be the where the dark matter event would live between these two blue bands. And you can see there's this big empty spot here. And as a consequence, they say that they've not found any dark matter. Now, you might say there are many events up here. Why are those not dark matter? Well, because of the fact that as you go up to higher velocities, the WIMPs have more energy, there's fewer WIMPs. And because of the nuclear form factor, if you have a lot of the expected distribution of events should be more or less exponentially falling. So the fact that you have 9 events up at high energies would suggest if it were dark matter, then you should have like 90 events at low energy. So the fact that they don't see any low energy allows them to place a very strong limit. This is their old data, it's not their, the xenon 100 data, which hasn't been, which is put out but has not been published yet. But you can draw these sorts of exclusion curves. The newest data are basically the same. They rule out this region up here is what would be the explained gamma, and you can see that it's ruled out by a couple of orders of magnitude. This is not a just missed it sort of thing. They've really, really that's right.
But the systematics for those events,
what are those events from? A lot of them.
So some of it is just a Gaussian leakage in the sense that you got some distribution here, so some events. Most of these events actually come from a type of background that different experiments call different things. The xenon 100 experiment calls it gamma X event. And what happens is that you've got if you have a situation where an electron comes and scatters once in a region where there's no electric field and then scatters in the region where there is electric field, then you collect the light from both of those scatters because they more or less happen at the same time. But you only collect the charge from the second one. And so you get an anomalously low light or ionization to light ratio or light ionization. So that's what they think most of them. Or their dark matter. Yeah.
This is
ruled out.
This is So CDMS. It's even more upsetting to me than the fact that Slovenia scored against the United States. we had a workshop in KIGP at the time. We were all very excited about it. You probably heard the rumors that they were about to announce the discovery of dark matter. And it was driven more by theorists than by anything else. But
those two events, even CDMS will tell you that they think that those events are probably back. One event for sure had a particular property in its CDMS uses a particular quality of the pulse itself, a timing property, in order to discriminate between background and signal. And they have a computer algorithm that determines what the pulse parameter is. And one of the events had like a sort of a premature spike. And so the algorithm they had did not actually end up finding the best minimum, the lowest chi-squared fit. And if you actually take the lowest chi-squared fit, then that event would not be in there. It would only be one event. The other one. Anyway. So CDMS is not pushing this discovery. I think I'm not going that route. One direction that you might want to take, that has been taken, is to think about the scenario of inelastic dark matter. This is actually fits very, very nicely into these ideas of new forces, but actually goes back about a decade. And the idea is very simple, is that you imagine that dark matter has an excited state, and so a dark matter particle comes in and scatters into that excited state. And if the splitting between those states is roughly comparable to the kinetic energy of a WIMP in the halo, this changes the overall kinematics of the scattering process, and so you have to go back and check your limits. In particular, what this tends to do is while ordinary WIMPs are maybe sensitive to a wide range, this is just the velocity distribution of WIMPs, a wide range, maybe an ordinary WIMP would see all particles above here. Inelastic WIMPs, because they have a kinematic threshold, only see the very highest tail. And so a heavy target like iodine will see more, a lighter target like CDMS will see fewer, which then favors Dhamma. There are a couple of other points. Since you're out on this tail, as you wiggle around summer to winter, you're moving around on an exponential, which means that your modulation, instead of being 4 or 5%, becomes something like 30, 40, 50%. So this is just a plot of what the modulation percentage is as a function of this splitting between the excited and ground states. So you can get really enormous modulation between those, which then favors Dhamma as well. And lastly, but perhaps more interestingly, is that if you look at the spectrum of a standard WIMP, which, like I said, is exponentially falling, in the inelastic scenario, because you have this additional parameter in there, which sets the dimensional scale, the spectrum tends to peak at finite energy. So that then favors Dhamma in all these ways. And so at least if you go back to 2008, you had this blue and purple region of parameter space. These lines here are all various experiments, and you want to live on this side of all those lines. The red and green lines you can ignore. They're sort of a model-independent analysis. Now, since 2008, a couple of things have happened. So that's filling you in on what the status was up until recently. So let me update you with what sort of happened over the last few months. Xenon 10 did a reanalysis where they actually managed to get rid of many of those events, not all, but many of those events, by looking at properties of distinguished things. And Zeppelin 3, which is another xenon experiment, did a reanalysis and also managed to get rid of many of their events as well. The CREST experiment, which has a tungsten target, so it should be in general sensitive to these sorts of things, went back and did a reanalysis of their data, and it looks very, very messy to you. So this is, again, some discrimination parameter here, and this is the recoil energy. And basically, the way it works is that dark matter should more or less live in this light blue band here. So they have some events, but probably not as many as you would expect in this kind of model. We don't actually know how many events they have because this is a select subset of their detectors that's unspecified. So it's kind of cheeky, actually. They showed this plot, and you have events in it, but you have no idea. They didn't tell you what the exposure was, so you actually don't know how to do it. Anyway, but they say that if they do the analysis, that they can rule out the inelastic scenario by about a factor of 4. So if you're a theorist, what you do, and I think most of us are, but if you're a model builder in particular, you want to go back and you want to question all the assumptions that you're making, because when you make those contour plots, you have to make a lot of assumptions that go into making an exclusion plot. And so I think that there's, in particular, three possibilities that keep this scenario running. I'm not going to talk about all of them. I'll just mention that, for instance, when you talk about non-Maxwellian halos, that opens up significant parameter space. There's actually a very key point that that sodium iodide is not really sodium iodide, it's sodium iodide with thallium. But I do want to talk about this third possibility because of the audience. So when we calculate the scattering of inelastic dark matter off of an experiment, we always assume that you're kinetically mixing with electromagnetism or you're mediated by a Z. So you couple the charge, or you couple to the weak charge. But it doesn't have to necessarily be like that. And if you want to think about what what are the properties that you might exploit? Like if you think, you know, how is DAMA different from all other experiments? One way that DAMA is different from all other experiments is that its target mass is very, very heavy. And inelastic dark matter exploits that anyway. But another interesting property about it is that it has a very large magnetic moment. So this is just a plot of some very popular dark matter targets, their mass along the x-axis and their magnetic moments along the y-axis. And you can see that cesium and iodine are sort of singled out uniquely as the targets which have both a large mass and a large magnetic dipole. So let me just very quickly describe how you might do this. There's sort of two setups that would allow you to couple to magnetism. The first, I think, is very, very cute. We've all been assuming that the kinetic mixing between the dark force and electromagnetism is an FF couple. But there's no reason why it has to be an FF couple. It could just as easily be an FF dual coupling. If, for instance, the states that you're integrating out to generate this coupling are magnetically charged. I mean, in principle, you don't know until you write down all the things in the dark sector whether they're magnetically charged or electrical charged. You don't know what F is F and what is F dual. So this ends up inducing an effective magnetic monopole under the dark force for our particles. And so instead of coupling to, instead of scattering coupling off the electric charge, you actually end up dominantly coupling to the magnetic dipole of the target nucleus. And again, parameter space opens up. Yeah.
Because this term will perturbatively vanish, right?
Well, you can't write in a potential formalism. You can't write both a magnetic coupling and an electric coupling using a perturbative formalism. But we can discuss this afterwards. But we believe we've convinced ourselves that still the scattering is still going to be off-tag.
Right?
Well, I'm assuming that the heavy particles or monopoles, they generate the kinetic mixing. That I definitely can write down, right? Because there I don't care what... there I'm still only specifying one particular charge that's appeared, right? So now you just dualize this, and I'm talking about an electric-electric mixing. We can discuss. But I certainly can write that term down as Lagrangian.
Yeah, but normally it's zero, right? Because it's still in the earth.
But this is an important because even in standard E&M, if you're talking about monopoles and electric charges and magnetic monopoles, and this we discussed this at Hopkins, right? Witten showed that if you put in this term, it doesn't have a zero effect, right? It actually generates a non-trivial epsilon electric charge for the magnetic monopole.
The magnetic charge.
So what's effectively happening here? Is analogous to the Witten effect, except for you're taking ordinary matter, right, which has an electric charge, you're putting in this epsilon FF dual term, and that generates an epsilon magnetic charge under the dark force for ordinary matter. But it's completely analogous to the Witten effect. So even in the standard model plus monopoles, FF dual is not totally irrelevant, right, because it generates this epsilon electric charge for monopoles.
Does this induce some CP violation?
It's very small. Yes, it does, but it's very small.
What's the parameter control?
The kinetic mixing parameter. This epsilon parameter. Yeah. Well, so it's this epsilon parameter, but you also need to keep in mind that to actually find out that you're magnetically coupled, then you need to know about fields in the other sector that are themselves electrically coupled. Right? So if you just draw a loop of this diagram, then you don't know whether it's magnetic or electric mixing, right? Because I can just write that F dual term as F. And then it just looks like an ordinary kinetic mixing coupling to something which is electric-electric mixing. It's only when I include another particle in the dark sector do I find out that I'm actually...
So this suppresses the effect.
That suppresses the effect. If Maxine doesn't want to go to electric-magnetic mixing, then you can also just think about conventional dipoles, right? So dark matter can have a conventional dipole. And in these ranges, parameter space. So For the sake of time, I'm not going to go into them, but I want to just emphasize that really, honestly, truly, I would rather there have been a signal by now. Really, if I were to be honest, and, you know, but I think that there are a number of, I think there's still a number of possible scenarios. Astrophysics and coupling to Thalion, those are somewhat tuned. I think these magnetic couplings are actually very, very easy to write down. And so none of these is quite as appealing to me as the original pair, but I think they're all still viable possibilities to make me very interested in what these results will the upcoming experiments will be. So moving on, the other excitement that's been going on in the field has been related to indirect detection. So dark matter was annihilating in the early universe. It should be producing a lot of signals presently in our galaxy, maybe gamma rays, positrons, or antiprotons. You tend not to look at protons or electrons because the universe is made out of protons and electrons. So it's much easier to find signals where your signal to noise is higher. And you probably heard about this. This is Pamela. If you didn't, let me just briefly tell you what it was. Pamela is a satellite experiment that studies cosmic ray antimatter. And they looked at the positron fraction. So that is the ratio of positrons to electrons plus positrons, the fraction of your stuff, your electronic stuff, which is in the form of antimatter as a function of energy. And these red dots are what they found. And what they found was that the fraction of antimatter goes up as you go to higher energy. So you expect, as you go to higher and higher energies, there to be fewer and fewer positrons compared to electrons because they're made through cosmic ray scattering processes. And they found a turnaround indicating that something out there was making a lot of positrons. And the amusing thing is that this is just a photograph taken of their data because for many, many months there was no actual paper out. And the only papers that were out used data that were taken off of photographs. But they finally did put out a publication, and these are their actual data here. This is some model of cosmic rays. You shouldn't take it too seriously because it could be going down like this, or it could be going across like this. Any one of those would be just as believable as this, but what's really convincing about this signal is that it turns up so sharply. That's very hard to mimic without having some primary source of cosmic rays. Added to this was the excitement that the Fermi collaboration, when they went and they looked, they cannot tell the difference between positrons and electrons. They have no magnetic field. But they saw a much harder spectrum of electrons than what would have been expected, which is this dashed blue line. So if you had just seen this Fermi result, you wouldn't have thought anything about it. You would have said, like, well, okay, it's hard, but we don't know why. But when you combine that together with the Pamela data, then you get excited because it's really telling you there's something going on. So a lot of people will say that this is just astrophysics, right? And certainly our default assumption should be that this is astrophysics. But if you want to tell the difference between astrophysics and dark matter, one thing you might do is look in the galactic center. Because the galactic center, you expect dark matter to spike. And so if you're producing a lot of cosmic ray positrons and electrons here, then you might produce, say, 10,000 times more in the inner region of the galaxy. And so in 2004, Doug Finkbeiner did an analysis of the WMAP data. Actually not with the intention of finding dark matter, but with the intention of trying to demonstrate that there was actually, that dust actually spins, which may seem very pedestrian to us, but what he found was very interesting. So what he did was he simply said, look, I know what all the different sources of microwaves are in the galactic center. I have dust, spinning dust. I have emission of soft synchrotron from electrons left over from supernova shock acceleration, and I have the CMB. And these things have different spectral dependencies, as well as Bremsstrahlung. And so I, being Doug, can subtract off each one of these things because I can make a map of the sky in low frequencies, and that gives me a map of, say, my soft synchrotron emission. I can make a map of the sky in high frequencies, and that gives me a map of dust. And then I can regress out these different maps through this process here, and at the end, he was left with what he termed the WMAP haze, which was updated by Dobler and Finkbeiner just a couple of years ago, the three-year data. And it's this excess of microwaves in the galactic center region, which is highly localized. So if you imagine, say, something which was an astrophysical source, astrophysical sources tend to trace the disk. they would have a signal which is more spread out. Dark matter would have a signal which is much more localized. So, let me actually skip out about polarization. So if this is true, the natural interpretation of this WMAP haze is that dark matter would be producing positrons and electrons in the galactic center. They then spiral in the magnetic field. And as they're spiraling in the magnetic field, they're synchrotron radiating in microwaves. You observe those microwaves. But those same high-energy electrons and positrons that are in the center of the galaxy should also hit starlight and kick that starlight up into frequencies that are visible for Fermi. So you can do a similar analysis with the Fermi data. You can say, I know what my sources of gamma rays are. I'm expecting them from Bremsstrahlung. I'm expecting them from pions. And so I can take maps of the Fermi data and subtract off from it what my sources are. And you find out that at the end of the day, you have, it's hard for you to see, but if you look on my laptop, you can see it more convincingly, that there are, in fact, excess residuals in the galactic center. So there is something in the galactic center which is producing a significant component of microwaves and a significant component of high-energy gamma rays. And that's very consistent with what you would expect from dark matter. Yes, it could be that the subtraction went wrong. Doug is an extremely serious guy, though. And so if you go and you talk to a lot of astronomer people, they'll say, if anybody else had done this analysis, they would be incredibly skeptical. But since Doug did it, they're only somewhat skeptical. But that said, the reaction from the Fermi collaboration when this result, this is not a licensed Fermi result. Okay? And when it was initially put out, the Fermi collaboration there were many different reactions from within the collaboration. There were reactions from, on the one hand, you did the subtraction wrong, to you did the subtraction right, but we know what it is, to our data are terrible, you shouldn't be using them. So they all agreed that it was not there, but they had very, very different reasons why. That's modified now. Talking to the Fermi people, I think that they actually agree that there is something, some excess of gamma rays there, I think. That's, again, just me talking to some people in the collaboration. I don't know that that's a representative, but I think that what I can say is that if you take, do I have that in here? I don't have it in here. If you take the Fermi model of gamma rays, right, they have their own model of what the galactic gamma rays are supposed to be, and you subtract their model from what they say is their best fit from their data, it's very clear. Very clear. So I think it's a. Yes, I'll talk about that. I'll talk about that.
Polarization analysis. They said they didn't see.
Okay, I was going to skip that for the sake of time, but yes. So WMAP7 synchrotron emission you expect to be polarized, and so when you look at the WMAP7 year data and you look at their polarization map as a function of across their band, it appears to have a complete uniform power law across the sky. So if this is microwave radiation, if this is synchrotron radiation, there has to be a reason why it's not polarized. And this is a quantitative question that still needs to be addressed. But at least in principle, these people here basically argue that if you have synchrotron emission coming from the interior of the galaxy, if there's sufficient turbulence in the magnetic field, then basically what it comes down to, right, is your magnetic field is pointing one way here and it's pointing another way there, then each individual source is polarized, but the ensemble is not. And so, but I should say, this is a calculation that needs to be done, what that turbulence is, that it would actually make this not be visible in their polarization. And
assume that the dominant magnetic field is sort of a large scale unturbulent field.
Well, they didn't assume anything. They just took a map of they took a polarization map of the sky, right, in different frequencies, and then they looked to see whether or not, as you go from frequency to frequency, whether or not that map was a good fit in every frequency bin, and it is, which indicates that
there's no additional component of electrons, which is harder in the galactic center than anywhere else. So they clearly see polarization, they see this emission, but this might all be coming from very nearby sources to be dominating what they're seeing. For instance, there's this object loop one, which completely dominates a lot of the galactic center. So, but it's a quantitative question. And if it weren't for this contribution from the Fermi, if there weren't this Fermi excess, I think I would be much more, skeptical of the WMAP page. But with that signal there, I think that we're seeing inverse Compton scattering from electrons. But that's a totally good question. That's right. But you could I mean, it's still something you want to calculate to figure out whether or not, right?
I don't think that there's any good way to measure that, because you can just use Faraday rotation, but that's not going to give you really what's localized in the galactic center. So,
let me just say that there's a bit of a problem in explaining these signals from dark matter. Basically, it comes from the fact that if you want to explain this amplitude of signal, we know how big the cross-section should be based upon what gives us the thermal relic density. And to get what you observe at Pamela, for instance, you need cross-sections which are about a factor of 100 times larger. And this is something that Maxime mentioned in his talk, which is that if you have these long-range forces between dark matter, one of the things that they do for you, in addition to giving you these cosmic ray signals, is that they basically invalidate the Born approximation for scattering, right? You can't just take plane waves and scatter them off each other because the wave function will be deformed. And you get this low velocity enhancement to cross-section, which means that in the present universe, you get an increase in the signal that you would not get in the early universe. So because I'm really going to be running out of time, let me just address two controversies with regard to this, this idea. There is a point made by these authors who claim that actually you cannot get a large enough increase to your cross-section. They said that the biggest cross-section that you can get is about a factor of 100, and they say that you need about a factor of 1,000. I think that while I disagree with their conclusion, I think that their point is well made. The point is that at this point, nobody in the dark matter community has kind of gone A to Z and said, here is a set of parameters starting at the very beginning, and here are the final signals, cosmic ray parameters, and everything like that. So it is something that's needed, and that's something that we're now doing. But there were a number of assumptions that went into this analysis that were not particularly, I think, appropriate. Probably the most important one in terms of interpreting signal is they assume that dark matter annihilates only into muons, which gives you a very soft signal. If you have dark matter which annihilates, as you would expect, through this vector portal into equal contributions of electrons and muons, the boost you need, instead of being 1,000, is more like 100 or 200. And those kinds of boosts, if you look at the full range of the parameter space, is actually possible. And actually, and something that Maxime pointed out, is that getting boosts larger than 100 can actually happen very, very, very easily. Right.
Because they emit this bound state, recombination to bound state to dark matter, which is, although parametrically the same, is enhanced numerically by a factor of 7. So.
And even so, as it turns out, the strongest constraints on this scenario are not coming from getting this large boost, but they're actually coming from something which is this question of what is going to test these models ultimately. And it turns out that there is one definitive way to test these models, and it comes from using the polarization data of the cosmic microwave background. Something that was actually pointed out some time back by Doug and Nikhil Padmanabhan, and then has been studied further recently in the context of these models by all these people, is that if you have a lot of dark matter annihilation in the early universe, then you're ejecting a lot of positrons and electrons during the era of recombination, which thickens the surface of last scattering and thus changes the polarization signal that you'll get with the CMB. It also leads to a damping of the higher L modes in the CMB, so this is degenerate with the inclusion of some tilt in the theory.
But even with WMAP 5, you can rule out a significant a range of parameter space. This is the cross section that gets ruled out, and this is the dark matter mass. And then these things, these lines here, are all models that can fit the data, depending on what the local relative density is. And so WMAP already is getting to the range where it can probe these things, and Planck will have good enough, assuming that Planck works as advertised, will be able to test this annihilation definitively. So if this dark matter annihilation is going on, then there is a there is an absolute test that will be done by Planck to see if it was going on in the early universe. So going forward, there are two things that I think are interesting. One is Planck, when it comes out with its polarization data, that will make this live or die. And going forward on the direct detection front, there are sort of three experiments that you should keep your eyes out for. CREST, if they can get their backgrounds under control. Xenon 100, they actually let me in, but I didn't destroy their experiment. And KIMS, which is the Korea Invisible Mass Search, and all the PIs named Kim, are all going to be reporting within the next year. Seriously. They're being funny. So let me conclude. I want to just, since we started with Bob Holden, who is at the University of Toronto, let's end by a quote by Howard Georgi and Mike Luke. Mike Luke, who is at the University of Toronto also. Because I like to keep this in perspective when I think about these astrophysical anomalies. I think that for sure our default assumption should be that they are astrophysics. But anomalies creep up on you very slowly. And if before they're 5 sigma, they're 3 sigma. And so you can either wait until they're 5 sigma, or you can think about them now. And so I like to think back to the way particle physicists approached solar neutrinos, which is the first thing that I worked on when I started particle physics. What they said was, most likely the solar neutrino problem has nothing whatever to do with particle physics. This is a great triumph that astrophysicists are able to predict the number of boron-8 neutrinos coming from the sun as well as they do within a factor of 2 or 3. It's good to remember that these unreliable astrophysical signals are very often our first sign of new physics. They are unreliable, but they are also where we discovered positrons, pions, where we discovered dark matter, not in cosmic rays, but discovered dark matter from astrophysics, where we discovered dark energy, where we discovered neutrino masses. So all these great discoveries were all made by astrophysics. And it's because the universe is this wonderful experiment going on all the time. So we shouldn't just be like, oh, we don't understand astrophysics. We should be actively thinking about them, because that's where so many of our big results come from. So to conclude, if there's a takeaway about how you should think about sort of the next coming months in this field, I think that there are very interesting hints. I have no idea if they are actually playing that dark matter or not, but they're certainly pointing us in an interesting direction as far as dark matter models go. There are a lot of interesting possibilities that can explain gamma. All of them will be tested in upcoming experiments. And if Pamela and Fermi are really showing us a sign of dark matter, then that's telling us that dark matter is a much, much richer sector than we had thought. And the greatest thing about this whole field is how rapidly it's changing. This is not standing still. It's being driven by data. And by the end of 2012, we should really know the answer to all of these questions. So I'll stop there. Thank you.
Questions?
At that point, you showed the curve with the distribution of the velocities for the waves.
Yeah.
What is the what basically says the mass?
Well, so basically the gravitational potential of the Milky Way sets the characteristic velocities of the waves. It's about 220 kilometers per second.
I heard a talk where they said that if Pamela only mistakes like 1 in 10 to the 10 protons for an electron, they would get this rise of energies. What do you think about that? Would this be possible, or are they sure they didn't do that?
Yes. I mean, so the principal background for Pamela are protons, because, of course, they have positive charge, and so do positrons. And at very, very high energies, it becomes hard to tell them apart. Now, it's important to recognize that Pamela is, you know, it's full of serious people, and it's not like they went in there like, oh, we don't have to worry about protons. The thing that they focused on, this was the thing, right? This was the make or break for their experiment. So they'd known about this from before they launched, and they spent all of their time trying to see whether or not they actually understand the proton contamination. And they claim that their proton contamination is, or their proton rejection is sufficiently good by more than an order of magnitude that you don't have to worry about it. Now, you can still worry about it, but it's, I guess the answer is that I've heard this comment before, but I've never actually seen anybody get up and say, you screwed X up, you know. It's an indefensible attack, right? Because you can say, oh, if you do this, then, you know, then that will trigger your signal. They can say, yes, but look, we've rejected protons. And you can say, well, what if you did it wrong? And they say, well, okay.
It's not one part in 10 to the 10. It's,
No, it's one order of magnitude. No, it's about one part in 10.
Part. Yeah. One part.
Yeah. They're safe by about an order of magnitude. Yeah. But.
No, but the rejection that they need is not 10 to the 10. Right?
No. It says the rejection is about 10 to the 4.
Five,
yeah.
10 to the 4.
I think they need 10 to the 4 and they have 10 to the 5. But AMS is. So there's two things about this. One is that the general consistency between Fermi and Pamela. So if you take Pamela and you add, they have an electron spectrum, and if you take their electron spectrum and you take their positron spectrum, they agree very well with Fermi, okay? So at least the set of things that they're calling electrons and positrons looks very much like what Fermi is calling electrons and positrons. So that gives me some confidence. The second thing is that AMS is in principle going to go up, and I'm told that they can confirm or refute this signal very quickly, basically to the extent where the analysis time and the paper writing time will dominate over the data time. So the Pamela people are, so yes, this is something to be concerned about, but it's not something that hasn't been thought about. They've thought a lot about this, and we'll know for sure sooner rather than later.
I'd like to come back to the previous question, to what extent one can test whether these things come from sufficient resources. Somehow, maybe you answered it, but I missed it.
Oh, so the real test is going to be the CMB measurements. So if dark matter is annihilated, and this won't test every single model, right? But if you have dark matter annihilated, it's actually a bit of a funny story. Doug McKeel wrote this paper back in 2004, and at the time they said, oh, look, you can have an interesting effect on the CMB, but you probably don't care because it has to be annihilating dominantly into this electronic stuff, and it has to have a cross-section about 100 times larger than the standard model cross-section. And so why would you care? But now, that's actually a kind of an interesting model. So basically, at Z of 1,000, dark matter is still annihilating at some low level. It's injecting all this energy into the CMB, well, into the plasma. It's going to keep the... it's going to keep the plasma ionized for a bit longer. That's going to change your CMB and give you some signals that Planck can in principle detect. So if it's really doing this, Planck will see it. If Planck does not see it, basically, I went too fast through this plot, but if you look at this cross-section versus mass plot here, right, so this is the dark matter mass, this is the cross-section. This light, somewhat darker blue, is ruled out by WMAP. And Planck will be able to do about an order of magnitude better. So if you look at sort of these bars are the upper and lower cross-sections that can explain Pamela for various models, okay, for, you know, this annihilation channel, that annihilation channel, whatever. And where they fit in this parameter space. And you can see that Planck will see all of them. So that's going to be difficult in terms of, like, actually pointing to the positrons that we're seeing and saying, oh, these, like, knowing for a fact that these are from dark matter. But if you don't see this signal, I think that a lot of this will go away. And if you do see this signal, then I think a lot of this will be very, very interesting.
Well, that's probably a good place to stop and break for coffee. We'll meet here again at 3.
Thank you.